Okay, חברים, ערב טוב. Our third lecture tonight has the somewhat controversial title, which has already kind of raised some questions from, I got telephone calls and emails and all kind of, it's called Embracing Auschwitz, the Perils of Our Holocaust Narratives. So before we start, I want to make sure that we proper contextualize our discussion, because obviously, like what I would like to believe any other Jew who is respectful of his or her past and present and future, I have nothing but the utmost respect to those who managed to live through the Holocaust and for those who perished. And that the goal and the aim of this lecture, of course, is not to undermine or to by any means trivialize their death. And you will see it throughout the lecture. Quite the contrary. The goal of this lecture today is to try and understand what is the Jewish context of Holocaust memory and memory making and meaning making, and how I believe it should be contextualized within a Jewish mind frame, rather than be used in a manner that is today central to Jewish identity formation and in a manner that I believe is more destructive than constructive. And it's going to be a difficult lecture. It's going to be difficult, probably for those of you who sit here, probably for those who listen to this or hear this. And actually, it's going to be so problematic that those of you who know me now, you'll see you've never seen me with notes before, ever. I never lecture with notes. This time I put some notes down, just to make sure that we are on the target at every given moment. I won't consult them much, but at least they will give us some sort of a structure as we move along. And I would like to start actually on a lighter note, and that is a Hasidic story. And in that Hasidic story, it says that a rebbe in a shtetl is getting ready for Yom Kippur, the evening of Yom Kippur, the most awesome day of the year. And he gets ready and he's dressed and everything. He starts walking to shul, and all of his disciples are behind him, walking behind him towards shul. They're all kind of getting ready for the... And all of a sudden he's struck by the awesomeness of the day. And he falls on his knees. Midway to the shul, he falls on his knees in the mud, raises his hands to heaven and says, "I'm not worthy, I'm not worthy." All of his disciples look at him. The Rebbe does that. They all fall on their knees immediately behind him. And they all raise their hands to heaven and say, "We're not worthy, we're not worthy." A Polish Gentile peasant walks by with his horse and a carriage, and he sees this and he's struck by the awesomeness of this spectacle, and he falls to his knees too. And he raises his hands and says, "I'm not worthy, I'm not worthy." So the Rebbe looks at him, looks at his disciples, and says to them, "Look who thinks he's not worthy all of a sudden." Now, the reason I'm saying this, the reason I'm telling you this story, which is funny, but it has a lesson which is not that funny. And that is that there is every people have a sense of exclusivity in their narrative. And Jews seem to harbor also a sense of exclusivity, not about only about their joys, but sometimes and even more so about their catastrophes. It is our Holocaust. It is you cannot touch it. It is our narrative, and we will mold it as we see fit. And I'm not saying it in a cynical way, but just to present a context wherein a narrative is structured by a certain agenda. It's not simply an objective flow of memories, but rather a construction of memories in a certain way as to highlight certain ideas, certain values, and so on and so forth. I remember when I was a little kid, a little boy in the mid-70s. And I remember that I participated in what I remember, my first Holocaust Memorial Day in Israel. It was in elementary school. And it was, when is the siren? At 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, I don't remember. And all the kids stood with the head principal in the center with the flag of Israel, and we all stood silent, and the headmaster said that this is in memory of the Holocaust of the Jewish people, the calamity that had befallen our people some 30 years past, and that we should all honor it, And I was so struck by that day. I was six years old. I'll never forget it. I went back home. My mother was waiting for me at home, and I looked at her and I said, "Ma, who from our family died in the Holocaust? Because I never heard you talk about it." And she looked and she says, "No one." I was angry. I said, "How come? How come nobody from my family died in the Holocaust? They give them such a grand memorial and commemoration. How come?" She said, "Zohar, we came from Persia. The Holocaust struck mostly European descent." And I felt almost an outcast. I felt as if I'm an outsider to my own people's narrative. I remember it very, very vividly. There is something about the Holocaust narrative, of course, that encapsulates us all under the canopy of a shared memory, that as a little kid I felt that I don't belong to. Of course, it would take me many, many more years and personal evolution to understand that you don't need to belong to something physically in order to remember it mentally and to become part of it in your life. But I remember that then it struck me as quite remarkable and powerful. So now let's delve into the subject matter. And I shall start by saying that had Judaism had in its mythological arsenal an advocate of malevolence, a Satan so powerful and autonomous as to defy God himself, him, her, itself, and to decide autonomously to afflict pain on people or on Jews, if we're talking from the Jewish mindset, there's no doubt that the Holocaust would be this Satan's tour de force. It will be the greatest medal to adorn his heartless chest. Had Judaism had such an autonomous antagonist to God's ultimate benevolence, this would be his tour de force. For better or worse, Judaism does not have such an entity in its mythological arsenal. Judaism does not recognize an autonomous agent of malevolence who stands in opposition to God and who is autonomous in its decisions to afflict pain, misery, or any other form of evil. And I'm taking you back now to my first lecture because I told you I'm going to return to this on my third. The monotheistic constitution of Judaism cannot afford the pretext of an autonomous agent who stands in opposition to God. The notion of God is one presents a profound problem to the question of good and evil, or good and bad. And indeed, when we look, for example, at the book of Job, which is one of the only books in the Tanakh, in the Bible, that presents the word Satan. You all know the book of Job? You all remember more or less the story? Right? So in the book of Job, look what it says on verse 6. I'll read in the Hebrew and then I'll translate. Vayi ayom vayavo bnei Elohim. Very interesting term in and of itself. The children of God, or the sons of God. Leitzyatzev al Adonai. Vayavo gam ha-satan betocham. And on that day, the rabbis will understand the term children of God as angels. The angels come to stand among God in the divine assembly, and the Satan comes within them. The Satan is recognized as a son of God, as a creation of God, as an angel. And the Satan now says to God, "I looked and I saw your servant Job," and God also says, "Wow, look at him, he's tzaddik and he's righteous and he loves me." And what does the Satan do? He says, "Of course he likes you. You gave him so-and-so, so much money, and so much, and wives, and children, and he's affluent, he's happy, what do you want him to curse you? Let's see, if you send him a little curve there in life, let's see what he does then." And how does God respond? Anybody remembers? Anybody remembers?
Even then he will bless.
But then Satan says to God, "Let me afflict some pain on him."
Don't take this
off. Yes, all right? So God now comes to Job and says, "Okay, I allow you to afflict pain on his flesh, but do not lay a finger on his soul." And what does Satan do? Precisely what God says. Satan doesn't argue with God. Whatever God says, that's what Satan does. In other words, The Satan, like any other angelic being, whether if it's a kruv or a saraf or a shaliach, whatever the word describes in the biblical narrative, and this is very important to remember, it is a being who is committed to its own raison d'être. It is an angel, it is a being created for a certain purpose by God. And Satan was created in order to be an advocate of evil, an adversary. That's his raison d'être. Unlike us, by the way, he does not enjoy free will. The Satan is completely committed to his adversarial role. This is Bible. I'll give you now an example from the Midrash. The Midrash Rabbah, gives us a fascinating story, one of the many Midrashim that were written about the binding of Isaac from Genesis 22. You all know the binding of Isaac story, I assume. And in that Midrash, God speaks to Abraham and says, take your child, your only one, blah, 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 and take him to the place that I will show thee. Abraham takes Isaac and two donkeys and two boys, as the Bible tells us, and they start marching. Now, if you remember, in the biblical, in the Torah, it says, all of a sudden, it says, after 3 days, they saw the place from afar. And many, many rabbis and many Midrashic writers say, wait a second. A father takes his son for such an ordeal, and the Torah doesn't tell us what happens between them for 3 whole days? That's a black hole. And black hole always invites Midrash. So there are a lot of Midrashim on those 3 days. And one of them says that on his way to the mountain, Abraham is now met by Satan, by Yavo Satan. And Satan comes to Abraham and says, are you nuts? What are you doing? You're hearing voices? Just because God told you to go and kill your son, you're just doing it? And Abraham in response says, that's what God commanded, I'm following God's command. So Satan doesn't budge. He now turns into a river to try and dissuade Abraham from moving on. So Abraham gets into the river with his donkeys and with her, and the river is flowing and flowing and flowing, overflowing up to a point that the water now touches Abraham's chin and he's about to drown. Abraham doesn't talk to Satan. He doesn't say to Satan, oh, please don't drown me. He lifts it up to heavens and he says to God an idiom that will become part of modern Hebrew until today. Higiu maim ad nafesh. Water is reaching my soul. I am about to drown. Are you going to allow this? And the Midrash ends by saying, Vayigar Hashem b'ma'ayan v'yavash. And God rebukes the river and he dries out. Abraham talks to God. He doesn't talk to any adversary angel, no matter what he does. The conversation between man and God. The same thing, by the way, goes with Job. Whenever Job is afflicted, you'll see that in the discussion, they never talk about Satan. They talk about God all the time. Is God good? Is God not good? They don't mention Satan at all. I'll give you another example. Seder Pesach. Chag Gadiah. You know the poem, right? Chag Gadiah. Chag Gadiah is some sort of a hierarchical poem, right? I mean, this one kills this one, this one kills this one, this one kills this one, this one kills this one. The shochet kills the ox. Who kills the shochet? Malach HaMavet, the angel of death. And how does the poem end? God kills Malach HaMavet. Anyone killing God there? No, because he is the supreme ruler. Malach HaMavet is just an agent. You want another example? There is a blessing that is called the blessing for good and evil tidings. That says that a person, chayav adam levarech al ra'a, kefi shehu mevarech al tova. A person must give blessing to God for evil tidings that happen to him, just as he does for good ones. Why?
Because they're both from the same source.
From the same source. Otherwise it would say, whenever good things happen to you, say thank God. Whenever bad things happen to you, talk to Satan. In other words, my friends, Judaism cannot afford the pretext of a dualistic theology when it comes to the question of good and evil. It's a profound, profound problem. Jews talk to God. And in that respect, one can say that the Shoah, the Holocaust, has presented to Judaism one of the greatest challenges it has ever faced. How do you explain such a calamity in face of a divine? How do you even approach it? And here we find a God that seems to come to mankind and say, whatever befalls you must find its origin in me. And if you think that I'm only the source of good, you misunderstand, or you are castrating the term one. You are castrating the unity of God. It is as if God tells us, I am the awesome, I am the awful, I am that I am. Now, deal with it. So it is indeed no wonder that when we look at the evolution of literature, theology, art, even religious discourse, in the wake of the Holocaust, we find a profound parallel that runs between the views of the Shoah and the views of God, or the most sublime, the most mystical. We see that they both run parallel. And I'll give you a few examples. There are quite a few examples where we find that the Shoah, and here I'm going to use the term Auschwitz with capital A-S instead of just saying the Shoah. I'll use that landscape. Auschwitz, referring to the whole thing, of course, not just to Auschwitz, as an antonym to Mount Sinai. If Mount Sinai is a moment of divinity puncturing history, a second of sublime inspiration that is infused within mankind's life and allows some sort of an eternal trajectory, an eternal ethical beacon, a revelation, we found that Auschwitz now is perceived as a de-revelation. We find Yaakov Gutstein saying, in Sinai we received the Torah, and in Lublin we gave it back. Dead men don't praise God. If we find in Sinai, for example, letters that are etched in stone, it's an eternal pulse from heaven that allows mankind to understand its own ethical journey with so-called 10 utterings that will from that moment on inform human trajectory. We find Samuel Bach, one of the greatest post-Holocaust artists, B-A-K. Google him when you have a chance. Samuel Bach, who now renders Mount Sinai with two tablets wherein the letters are laying shattered on the floor amidst ashes and burning bodies, sucked out of their rocky sockets in some sort of a call of despair, of a rude awakening, of anger, of dismay, a broken keychain that shows that there is some sort of a breach between God and man, some sort of a betrayal, some sort of a de-revelation. If we know in mystical literature that the Shekhinah is sometimes associated with the moon, with the Levana, the female aspect of the moon, in Jewish mystical literature, we find Abraham Sutzkover now depicting a picture for us where a man, after the Holocaust, brings a feather to the nostrils of the moon just to realize that the feather is not moving, the moon is dead. And just as in the most sublime moment of human realization of the divine, as we read, for example, in the book of Psalms, chapter 65, verse 2, Lecha dumia betzion, Lecha dumia tehila. Utter silence is the utmost glorification of your name. Silence, the inability to render God, the sublime, with a word, with a language, with the conventional medium of human communication. We also find Aaron Appelfeld, calling the martyrs of Auschwitz the martyrs of silence. We find post-Holocaust anthropologists and historians speaking about the need for linguicide. We find Primo Levi saying that had Auschwitz existed another 6 months, there would be a need for a new language to describe it. Because the words that we use, such as hunger and fatigue and fear and agony, they're not a bridge between us, they're a breach. The same Primo Levi, and I assume you know who I'm talking about, the same Primo Levi, who in his immortal work, If This Be a Man, If This Be a Man, which was translated in the American English when it was published in the 60s in the United States to Survival in Auschwitz, because they were so uncomfortable with the call of Primo Levi, If This, You Judge, If This Be a Man. Primo Levi, as his preface to the If This Be a Man, he starts with a little poem. And this atheist calls his poem the Shema. Taken right from the most noble, sublime moment of the Jewish people. And Primo Levi, in his 8th chapter of this book, he calls it this side of good and evil. Challenging your ability to at all conceptualize that world. The same thing one finds when we look at those mortals who have experienced, to whatever degree, the sublime on the one hand and the Holocaust on the other hand. Those who have experienced the sublime are usually called prophets in our narrative. And when we look at the prophets, we find that they are people that on one hand are perceived as beacons of morality and ethical behavior. They are held with reverence because they seem to live simultaneously in multiple worlds. And at the same time, if we really read some of those prophets, we find them to exist in a realm of existential loneliness, of profound solitude. Because what they see, what they understand, is beyond the ability to articulate. Their soul is forever entrenched in the gap between experience and expression. And the same thing we find with those that we called, and I'll tell you why I profoundly disagree with that term, Holocaust survivors. People who managed, some of them, to become real beacons of a human trajectory, an ethical trajectory for mankind, by virtue of having experienced something that is so radically beyond our ability to fathom, let alone empathize with, because we haven't been there. And at the same time, people who continuously exist in multiple worlds, people who continuously suffer existential solitude, people who continuously suffer the problem of language in an attempt to deliver something that they ultimately know is beyond expression. What Katzetnik Yechiel Dinur will call in his testimony in the Eichmann trial, Planet Auschwitz. What would ultimately lead Judah Bauer, one of the greatest historians of the Holocaust, to ask, is the Holocaust at all explicable? It is therefore that a historian of the Holocaust would eventually come and say, when you come to the Holocaust, when you look at the Shoah, you say to yourself, on the one hand, how can I speak of this? How can I render this experience within the medium of conventional language? How can I even dare to suggest to humans who have not been there that they can understand, that I can convey that I have the moral right to insert that into the medium of a book, of a text, of a study, of analysis, of a lesson plan. How can I speak of it? How dare I speak? And at the same time, how dare I not to speak? If I remain silent in light of this, what can we do? And he ends up by saying, speaking, not speaking, twin terrors. Twin terrors. No matter which path you take, you have chosen a terrorizing path. On the one hand, we cannot allow ourselves not to remember, let alone not to remind. But on the other hand, we cannot but ask ourselves, what do we remember and how do we remind? Which now leads me to the second point. When Winston Churchill saw the footage that came back with the British brigade, the British troops that came back from among the Allies that liberated Europe. Anybody knows what Winston Churchill called what would later be called the Holocaust? The Holocaust was not obviously called the Holocaust immediately in 1945. It would take a few years. Anybody knows how Winston Churchill called it? He called it the crime that bears no name. Exactly for the reasons that I just told you. It doesn't have a name. Because once you give it a name, you have encapsulated it with something that we can recognize, with something that we can compare. But at the same time, we find Jews, of course, and humanity as a whole, looking at the Holocaust and realizing that it cannot allow itself not to remember and not to remind. And we saw among Holocaust, again, those who are called Holocaust survivors, two main schools of thought. The one I will call, for simplicity's sake, the Elie Wiesel school of thought, and the other one, for simplicity's sake, the Primo Levi school of thought. Elie Wiesel dubbed the Holocaust Mysterium Tremendum, the tremendous mystery, something that is ultimately beyond human comprehension, something that lies beyond human understanding and therefore should never allow itself to fall within the conventional mediums of human analysis, human research, historical research, and so on and so forth. That is not to say, and Elie Wiesel says it quite explicitly, people should study the Holocaust, should learn about it, but they should never aim to suggest that they can figure it out, that they can explain it and give a lesson plan in light of the Holocaust. Elie Wiesel, mind you, at a certain point, had an existential crisis with God when it came to the post-Holocaust world. And if you remember, those of you who read Night, in his book Night, there's an awful scene there where the Nazis are hanging a 5-year-old girl for smuggling bread or a potato or something. And he's standing there with the rest of the inmates watching this heinous crime. And one of the inmates next to him taps him on the shoulder and looks and says, "Where is God? You know, you tell me, where is God?" And Elie Wiesel himself says, "God is dead. He's hanging in the gallows right there. He's hanging right there." It would take Elie Wiesel quite some time to revisit his relationship with God. It would be many years later that he would be asked by someone, by an interviewer, "What, when you said God is dead," and then in other books like Gates of the Forest and other works of yours, you seem to have re-entered into dialogue with God. What happened there? And Elie Wiesel gave quite a powerful answer to that. He said, it took me a while to realize, he said, and I'm paraphrasing, that while Auschwitz with God is a profoundly difficult concept to fathom and accept, Auschwitz without a God is even more horrendous a possibility. Which now leads me to the second school of thought. And that is Primo Levi's school of thought. And Primo Levi would refuse to look at God as any form of an excuse or any form of a target or a means by which the Holocaust can be either explained or fought against. Primo Levi wanted to bring the dialogue into the realm of humans. If you want to understand what caused the Holocaust, look at human beings, and you'll understand what happened to the what brought the Holocaust. Look at human behavior. Look at what we are capable of doing. And you decide if this be a man. Not just the victim. The perpetrator is what? So now we ask ourselves, what do we remember and how do we remind? And I would like to take you to two verses from the Torah. Both of them have to do with Amalek. You know that term, Amalek? Who is Amalek? What is Amalek? Don't be shy. Amalek is a people that appear in the Torah as the people who chase the Israelites during the Exodus, right? From behind and fight them. And they become in Jewish tradition, they become the synonym for all the major evildoers to the Jewish people. So Hitler is also called Amalek, and the Nazis are called Amalek, and the Amalek. Do you remember what the Torah says to us about Amalek? How should we remember or not remember Amalek? Anybody remembers? Okay. So there is one commandment that says, Machot timche et zecher Amalek mitachat l'shamayim. You should erase the memory of Amalek from under the heavens. But there is another one that is as powerful that says, Zachor et asher asa lecha Amalek betzidcha mimitzrayim. Remember that which was done to you by Amalek on your way out of Egypt. Let's start with the latter. Let's start with the remember. Or you know what? Let's make it even more interesting. Let's start with the former. Machot imche et zecher Amalek mitachat l'shamayim. You should utterly blot out, eradicate the memory of Amalek from under heaven. Where does it appear? In the book of Deuteronomy. I just told you. In the Torah. The Torah, we read every year the same parasha, and we read, you should blot out the memory of Amalek every year, every year, every year, every year. It is as if I'm coming to you and I say, forget, 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 forget. How the hell am I supposed to forget if you're reminding me every year? There's a great paradox here. Because you're actually being perpetually reminded of the mitzvah of forgetting. It's impossible to forget. Because you continue to remind me. So maybe there's something else there. Let's see. The second verse comes and says, Zachor et asher asa lecha Amalek. Remember that which was done to you. And then eradicate the memory of Amalek. In other words, there is a distinction between the perpetrator, which you should completely erase from memory, blot out. Amalek is not important. And the act which was done to you. In other words, remember the felony. Remember the crime. Don't remember the criminal. Now guys, you all live in Tel Aviv, I guess. Most of you live in Tel Aviv. Next time you go to Rabin Square, and you go to the area, the Rabin Memorial. I assume that most of you, if not all of you, have been there. Have you looked at the commemoration slots, the small slots that are etched into the pavement that show where Rabin was and where his bodyguard was? Have you looked? Go and look. What does it say? Wonderful. Why doesn't it say Yigal Amir? Because you should eradicate the memory of Amalek. You should remember his act. The murderer, it says. Not the name. Now why am I telling you this? If we are to remember the Holocaust, the Shoah, we should blot out the memory of Amalek, and we should remember the act itself, but not just the act of murdering 6 million Jews, but rather another distinction. How did Jews respond to the Holocaust? How did Jews respond, live through, or even die through what had happened to them? What I'm suggesting here, that should be a distinction between what I call events that happened to Jews and Jewish events. And I would claim that the Holocaust is not a Jewish event. The responses of Jews to the Holocaust are the Jewish event. There's nothing Jewish about Auschwitz. There's nothing Jewish about gallows, about gas chambers. There's nothing Jewish about the systematic annihilation of a people. There's no Jewish value present in Majdanek, in Sobibor. None. These are not Jewish landscapes. There's nothing Jewish about the destruction of the Second Temple. Megillat Eicha, the Book of Lamentations, is a Jewish event. But not Megillat Churban HaBayit. Such a Megillah does not exist. There is no scroll that is called the scroll of the destruction of the temple. We should make a distinction between events that happened to Jews and challenge the set of values and beliefs of the Jewish people, oftentimes to a radical extreme, stretched our belief, broken it at times, and nobody can judge anyone, nobody is judging anyone, put our values to the utmost challenge of the test. But distinct between those and between the myriad of Jewish responses to those that constitute the Jewish event or the Jewish events.
The event happens to us, but how we commemorate it or remember it is the Jewish event. For better or for worse.
Yes, and that's where I want to lead us, because the second part of my lecture will be about how to remember. I'll give you an example. In 1995, I had the honor of leading one of the 7 delegations that I would end up leading to the March of the Living, which is a program that brought Jewish teenagers from all over the world to a week in Poland. The pinnacle of which, if you can use the word pinnacle, was Holocaust Memorial Day in Auschwitz-Birkenau. And then a transition to Israel to commemorate Memorial Day, and immediately followed by Yom HaTzmaut, Independence Day, which was and still remains a powerful program in the Jewish world. However, when devoid of context, and when used in a landscape that is not a Jewish event, the message that stems from some of the educational experiences of in such a place profoundly border on the manipulative rather than the educational. And in my opinion, they create a very dangerous path for Jewish identity formation. I'll give you an example. And again, it's very important for me that you understand that I'm not undermining in any shape or form the blessed memory of the victims and the blessed life of those who lived through this horrific event. When a guide stands in Majdanek, in Lublin, I don't know how many of you have been there, but there is a memorial site there that consists of about 8 tons of human ashes. It's a very, very powerful memorial site. Like a huge mound of human ashes, people who were burnt in the crematoria right next to you. It's a place that commands attention. It's a place that commands respect. It's a place that commands memory for all the right reasons. It is not a Jewish site. And what had happened there has nothing to do with Judaism. I'll explain in a minute. And to stand in a place like this, and to say to people, because of what had happened to them, you must be Jewish, is not the right thing to do.
Oh,
not all the time.
Jewish, or you must
remember? No. You have to continue the legacy of the Jewish people. And the reason I'm saying this is not because I don't believe that we should learn about what had happened. Quite the contrary. I was there 7 times. I continue to teach the Holocaust. But we have to understand, my friends, that if we build a Jewish narrative that is based on the tragedy that had befallen the past, and on this we try to create a skeleton of Jewish present, this skeleton is going to be devoid of any meaningful bone marrow. And ultimately it will collapse. In that respect, there is a very fine line between education and manipulation. And there is a very fine line between education and contextualization. We have to understand that the Holocaust yields an incredible emotional interest. For all the right reasons. If that emotional interest is not put within a far greater context that celebrates and is proud of Jewish life rather than Jewish death, we'll end up with a generation of people for whom the justification for being Jewish is more the anti-Semitic rather than the Semitic.
What's interesting?
This is why I'm calling it Embracing Auschwitz. Not because I want to embrace Auschwitz. It is because of the danger of turning Auschwitz into the byword of Jewish identity formation.
Is this how these trips are run?
No, and again, I'm giving you an example. There are many, and since I'm being recorded, I want to put it very clearly. Yad Vashem and other organizations who lead these trips today are far more aware of what I'm talking about than many others. It's not what I'm telling you. It's not just me.
When the children from here go, where is the stress put?
No, that's right. I'll, in the second hour, I'll talk about the whole structure and I'll talk about the revisiting of Jewish landscapes. But there are many, many still issues that need to be resolved here. What I'm trying to say at this juncture is that in the post-Holocaust era, the Holocaust has become the most powerful and in many cases the central the central item in Jewish educational settings for Jewish identity formation. And the reason for it is because, first, it yields an incredible emotional interest. It is a quick fix. It can resonate relatively quickly. And in many cases, and I'm being very honest here, I think that it is an excuse not to deal with many other elements of Jewish education in which we have failed. And the Shoah allows us to kind of pull the blanket to the part where we want to deal with it, rather than deal with positive education in which we have not yet mastered how to create interest and yield emotional investment in that. And what we are creating is we are in many cases creating a generation for whom, and here I'm talking about research, it shows that for many young people, the Holocaust is perceived as the most significant Jewish event in modern history. Right now I'm talking about our approach to Holocaust education. The reason for which is, and then we'll take a break, is that the youngsters who deal with the Holocaust, let alone those who deal with the Holocaust on an experiential level, have absolutely no ability, let alone the knowledge base, to contextualize that experience intellectually and to put it within the right mind frame that allows the Holocaust to be understood with a far greater legacy of Jewish life. What people fail to understand most of the time is that for 6 million Jews to have died, 6 million Jews had to live first. And we need to celebrate that life. That's the Jewish value. I'm going to end up by giving you an example from Majdanek. And then we'll take a break and we'll take questions in the second hour. In Majdanek there was a ritual where the commandant would force Jews to pay homage to a golden eagle that was posted at the center of the camp. This is idolatry. And you know that idolatry for Orthodox Jews is a yareg uval yavor. You are allowed to die and not. This is not a Jewish event. You know what's a Jewish event? That many Jews would come every morning, pick up ashes from the floor, put it in their pockets, stand around that pillar, take the ashes out, throw them on the ground and pray Kaddish profusely. That's the Jewish event. That's what should be remembered. And we'll talk more about that as we construct now the landscape of Holocaust memory between non-Jewish landscapes and Jewish landscapes in Poland that should be part of the way we remember the Holocaust. Bless you. Okay, guys, let's take a 7-minute break. Keep what happened in the year 1099? The?
Crusades.
Hmm?
The Battle of 1099.
The Crusades.
The Crusades.
From 1096 was the edict. 1099 they arrived in Jerusalem. A lot of Jews died in the process. 1270, anybody knows?
No.
Well, at least the end of, without the exception of Ashkelon, but you're right, but another thing happened in London.
Oh, the expulsion of the
York. Not expulsion, York. The York, there, the burning York. Jews on the, right? 1492. 1497. Another expulsion, this time from Portugal. 5 years later. 1880. The pogroms and the
pogroms, yeah.
Well, the Sufot Benegev, winds of the Negev, 1948, and 1948-1949, the War of Independence, 1956,
Sinai,
1967, 1973, you know where I'm going, right? 1982, blah, blah, blah. Okay, now let me ask you, what happened in 1314?
I know where you're going.
None of you knows. You know why?
Because it was
positive.
It was a normal. Actually, it was a great year. It was a great year.
Jews are only happy when they're miserable.
They had a fantastic relationship with the Muslims. They were flourishing in Europe. They're great year.
Spain.
We have mastered the rhetoric of crisis to such a degree that it has virtually shaped our own memory, and not only that, it informs its trajectory. Now, this is not just it's not a Jewish problem. It's the way humans think, but because of our own history and the way we shaped it.
Well, we didn't know it was shaped for us.
No, I will not. Nothing is shaped for you. You know, when you say it's shaped for me, it's like you're telling me that I'm giving you a headache. I'm not giving you anything. If you don't want, don't take it. We shape our memory. Nobody shapes it for us. We shape it.
I'm not talking about memory. I'm talking about the event.
There is no such a thing as an event, but the memory of the event. You cannot tell me anything about an event. Only what you remember of it and the words you decide to use in describing it. The event as such does not exist.
And which event?
And now we ask ourselves, what events do we remember? And how do we now narrate them for ourselves and for the next generation? Now, I'm not saying, of course, that the memory of the Holocaust as a horrific event is not right. Of course it is right. It's a horrific event. All I'm saying is, can we reshift our memory as to contextualize this type of memory? And more than that, to allow certain landscapes to correspond with a more Jewish, positive, meaningful memory of the Holocaust as well, as a means to allow our younger generation to understand that Judaism at its heart is not a culmination or accumulation of tragedies, but rather a sustenance of life despite of the tragedies. And that's the difference. I am not Jewish because of the Holocaust. I am Jewish despite of the Holocaust. And that's the real difference between the two systems that I'm trying to show here. Now guys, in the late 90s, Alan Dershowitz, the professor of law at Harvard, wrote a book called The Vanishing American Jew. And in that book, among other things, he said that the young American Jew is sick and tired of what he calls this diet of tragedy. He looks around himself, she looks around herself, and quite frankly, they don't necessarily experience this rhetoric that seems to perpetuate a fear of an impending doom as a means to sustain Jewish identity. They don't. And when you present them that language, you create a sense of a dissonance which leads them to vote with their feet. This is not my experience anymore.
That's his opinion.
Yeah. Now I think that it is well grounded too. It's not only his opinion, it's the opinion of many, many others, myself included, that comes and says that any body, any organ that is sustained by a diet of a void will end up dying. And if you want to create, what I said before, a meaningful Jewish body, you have to sustain its skeleton with a meaningful bone marrow. And tragedy is no bone marrow. For education to work, especially when we talk about experiential education, there needs to be a correspondence between the landscape in which we teach and the ideas which we try to present, to put forward. If we try to put forward the belief in Jewish values, the joy in the accumulated wisdom of Judaism, a critical mind of the challenges that Judaism has, the contradiction between Jewish ideas, between different Jewish voices, but a real immersion in the evolution of the Jewish life throughout the generation, the evolution of Jewish culture in what it holds dear to itself throughout the generations, we need to find corresponding environments, corresponding landscapes to support such messages. If one of the messages we want to bring forward is that Judaism sanctifies life and not death. Is that Judaism tries to perpetuate the joy of life. And that life overpowers death in Judaism. What do we say on an open grave when we bury a loved one?
Kaddish.
What is Kaddish? What is it?
Praise
it what?
Praise
great. How many times the word death, void, anger?
Never.
How many?
One.
What is the Kaddish? The Kaddish, in many ways, is actually a ladder. It's a letter. It's a letter that allows, right, the soul to ascend to its creator. It's actually a celebration of life. How do you call a cemetery in Hebrew? Bet Kol Chai, Bet Chaim, Bet Almin, which is Bet Olamin, the house of all living, the house of eternal life. The word death does not appear in a cemetery. Nor does the concept. My friends, when you talk about life, when you talk about the celebration of life, when you talk about the sanctity of life, Auschwitz is not a corresponding environment. When you try to explain what were the Jewish values that the Nazis tried to eradicate, Auschwitz is not the place to do it. When you try to explain what happened to Jews, that's Auschwitz. What people try to do to Jews, that's Auschwitz. But that's a small part of the Jewish saga which you should tell. Guys, the Holocaust, and again and again and again, I'm saying here to the microphone, to the camera, and to all of you, I'm not belittling. God forbid. But the Holocaust was a number of years which put a profound challenge to a saga that has lasted and continues to last for thousands of years. It tried to put a dent in a Jewish trajectory. And I want to live in a world that can look myself and the world and my next generation in the face and said it failed. This is why I have such a big problem with us calling people who managed to live through the Holocaust, and we still call them Holocaust survivors. And we don't do this out of this, of course we do it out, but I don't agree. I refuse to put that emblem on them. They lived for many years after many of them. And by the way, many of them never survived. Many of them maybe lived after the Holocaust, but they never survived. Speaking of Primo Levi, for example, or many, many others. To assume that they survived it is also some sort of a pretension. But I refuse to identify their lives based on that, again, event. I refuse to identify them for the rest of their life based on that event. They are Jews who went through the Holocaust. But they are Jews, first and foremost. They will decide what kind of Jews. They will decide if they even call themselves Jews. God bless them. They will decide whatever they want. No one, definitely not me, will judge them. But I refuse to call them Holocaust survivors, because by doing that, I'm actually sanctifying or putting on a pedestal that moment in time. And I allow it to take over the rest of their lives, either before or after the Holocaust. I refuse to allow the Holocaust to become a pivotal moment in the Jewish narrative.
Mm-hmm.
People that came before, like in the 38 and the Tzionim, they came and they left religion, and they were right in a way, they left their families that perished. And for the Haredim, they, for them, the Shoah in a way is the fact that all these people were right, that the ones that left, they survived the Holocaust and they were right, and you know, in a way, there's a different. But nobody knows how to continue. The Chilonim will become, you know, have left religion completely, and the Haredim have gone back and tried to, you know, they have a big trouble explaining what happened.
They blame it on the reform.
First of all,
I understand what you're saying in terms of Judaism, but when you're talking about Israel, you have a huge difference between communities about how to understand this in terms of statehood as well and nationalism, which is what formed Israel.
Well, first of all, you brought a lot of issues into the table, which each one of which warrants a whole discussion in and of itself, which unfortunately we don't have the time to have. I would say, for the record, that the assumption or the hypothesis that Israel was formed on the ashes of the Holocaust is highly misleading and problematic. And I would even venture to say, officially, that the fact that the Holocaust was entered into Israel's Declaration of Independence, it is mentioned there officially, Shoat Yehudei Europa is mentioned in the scroll, was the single greatest mistake that the National Assembly has made by putting the Holocaust as a justification for the establishment of Israel. And the reason I'm saying this is because there's no doubt, I mean, I will definitely agree that the Holocaust has expedited international understanding or legitimacy for the Jewish call for returning to its homeland. But I would still advise you to remember that the Zionist movement has started way before.
It started when emancipation didn't work for Jews. Mm-hmm. All the countries, you know, in Europe.
Yeah.
It didn't, you know.
But that's not the Holocaust.
It didn't help the Jewish people.
Yeah, right. The entire literature is positive and it's
so about that's,
the future.
So that's not the Holocaust.
The entire Zionist literature is positive and about the future.
Well, again, I just want to remind you that, again, the Israel is not the result of the Holocaust, but the establishment of Israel was definitely expedited because of the Holocaust. However, to create a linear, logical flow from Holocaust to Israel is highly problematic. And by the way, it has a lot it raises a lot of educational questions also about the Zionist narrative in that respect.
But the people that were Zionists, mm-hmm, were people that moved away from Judaism.
Not all of them, no. I think that you're creating, first of all, Tkufat Haskala, the time of enlightenment. First of all, I would like to remind you a number of things. First of all, there isn't such a thing as the Zionist movement in the singular. Because actually, if you study the history of Zionism, there were many Zionist movements or branches within this notion, one of them being religious Zionism. In other words, that people who saw quite a clear synthesis between theological and religious and traditional way of life and the establishment of the state of Israel in a modern form. I'll even say more than that. If you actually look at the first Aliyot and you look at those who have established the big cities that started emerging here in the beginning of the 20th century, such as Tel Aviv and Petah Tikva and Rehovot, and all of them were people who were either religious Jews. The people behind Neve Tzedek and Achuzat Bait, all of them are big yarmulkes, big beards. The same thing in Tel Aviv and Rehovot and others. Or people who decided to venture off to look at other ways of expression, but still with profound knowledge and respect to the tradition that they brought from home. I think that the clear dichotomy, that this notion that we call secularism in its so-called purest form, or pure form, is a much, much later development in the history of Israel. So I would just advise us not to oversimplify.
Did that process happen with the Holocaust?
I'm sorry?
Did that process of secularism not happen because of the Holocaust?
No, I don't think so. It might, again, it might have expedited it. There are a lot of
people that apparently, from what I've read, already the third era of people that came after the Holocaust were very badly treated by those who had come a little bit earlier. they were seen as...
Are you talking about Holocaust, again, Holocaust survivors who arrived?
These people were looked at themselves as savages, and they didn't, you know, there was a desire to keep away anything that had to do with Europe.
Right. But that, I think, that doesn't have to do with the Holocaust per se, as much as it has to do with the new Hebrew, the vision of which has emerged already before the Holocaust. And what is called this Shlilata Gola, the kind of delegitimization of the Gola state.
Is that not this, what we're talking about?
It started before. I think that the Holocaust, again, expedited and brought to the surface a lot of issues that were at the back burner before. But again, you're raising a lot of big, big, big questions here. And I'm not even touching about post-Holocaust theology and the perception of God and what happened with the Haredim. And, yeah. And, you know, there are a lot of works that were written about this. What I'm trying to say here is, and again, we won't have time to treat Israel as a landscape of Holocaust memory, which is a topic unto itself. The main point I'm trying to raise here is that the use of Nazi landscape for the perpetuation of Jewish values does us a great disservice in the long run.
How would you, if you had the possibility to redo March of the Living?
I did.
Okay, but so you're bringing in these concepts now of the Jewish values instead of, like, for example, the Kaddish instead of the Golden Eagle and other things. But, I mean, coming from the dead end of the Jewish world, Sweden, so...
I wouldn't use that term, definitely not in this lecture. Coming from the...
Kildesak. So that was one of the discussions being active, that, you know, how do we do it? Because exactly what you're saying, for a lot of people, it was the only way of for the youth to identify, and they choose it, although some leaders really had your opinion and said it's a negative way. So how would you, or how is it now, and in what way are the concepts changed, and
fantastic.
What can be continued?
Fantastic question. First of all, I want to make it very, very clear that some of the things that I'm talking about here are already have been implemented by many, many smart men and women in Yad Vashem and other organizations who've been doing great job at that. It's not, however, the landscape or the landscapes of Auschwitz, Birkenau, Sobibor, Treblinka, different cities where you go in Poland and other places and you see this is where Jews live, this is a landscape marked by the presence of Jewish absence. It is marked by the hollowness of Jewish life. It is actually a celebration, quote-unquote, of Jewish void. And I want to find a landscape that is marked by Jewish presence. Now you can ask me, where on God's green earth can you find in Poland or other lands a landscape that is marked by Jewish presence? And I will take you to the most incredible landscapes of them all, the one which you believe is a dead landscape and in fact is a very much living landscape. And that's Jewish cemeteries. Ah, here's you. Well, Jewish cemeteries? When were you last in a Jewish cemetery in Poland?
Well, in Slovakia, it's almost.
All right. Has anybody here been? Prague is a great example. Where, in Okopova?
In
Warsaw, the big one in Warsaw?
In Warsaw as well.
The big one?
Riga.
Riga. All right. Guys, when you enter a Jewish cemetery, this place that is the final resting place for a Jew is in fact a landscape that is saturated by Jewish values, by Jewish symbols, by Jewish ideas, by Jewish texts, and by Jewish messages.
And Jewish void.
And
Jewish void. There's nothing there.
No. Quite the contrary. a Jewish cemetery.
No, but it showed in Poland, when you go into a Jewish cemetery, there's all there is the cemetery. There's no life.
No, there is no life outside.
That's right.
That's what I said.
That's right.
But the landscape now itself,
no,
when you enter.
Only that landscape.
Ah. So now I'm asking myself, if I have a landscape to choose from, and all I'm surrounded by is this presence of absence, where do I find a landscape that still has a presence of the value of life, although I don't find living people there? But don't confuse life
living
with
Judaism.
Or a living Judaism. However, now let me ask you a question, guys. When a group of Jews build a new settlement, wherever they are in the world, what are they supposed to build first?
Cemetery.
Cemetery, and then?
Mikveh,
and then? First, before? Cemetery, mikveh, school. School. Synagogue, my friends, is not a requirement. You can pray at a house. You don't need a house of assembly. That's a cemetery, mikveh, school. A place that does not have one of those three is not worthy of Jewish living, according to Shulchan Aruch. Not worthy of Jewish living. Guys, a cemetery is a place that is not merely a place where you deposit the body of a dead Jew. If you actually enter a Jewish cemetery, what you see is a remarkable portrayal of the Jewish living landscape that has lived there. If you ever enter a Jewish cemetery, here you gave us an example of Prague. Who are buried at the very front of the Jewish cemetery when you enter it? The leaders of the community. The big rabbis. Who is buried outside the fence? The ones who committed certain...
suicide.
Either committed suicide or did something else that is of major offense to Jewish values. Sometimes back in earlier times, even outside the fence, and there is quite a derogatory term for that burial. It's called the burial of an ass. Kvuat chamo, that's how it's called. There is a distinction between the symbols that are being used.
Do you say Kaddish for people like that?
It depends who you ask. It depends who you ask. You can see the distinction between the burial of a man and the burial of a woman. From afar, you can see sometimes that you're looking at the tombstone of a woman. How would you know? What is one of the mitzvot, of the most distinct mitzvot of a woman upon her marriage? What?
Lighten
the Shabbat candles. Right? If you walk into a Jewish cemetery, bless you, and from afar, you see a couple of broken Shabbat candles.
It's a woman.
Not just a woman, a married woman. If a married is a Kohen, if he was a philanthropist, you will see a hand in an alm giving money. If he was a scholar, you will see a Torah book or a whole bookshelf on the tombstone. And then take the text. Guys, look at our cemeteries today. Oh, they're such a waste. In my opinion, they're so... They're such a mirror of the way we live our life today. Seriously.
It's like Disney World.
No. I'm not talking about... No.
Yes.
Here lies, ta-ta-ta, Moshe Ben Sasson. God forbid, I don't want to offend any Moshe Ben Sasson. Or we get wishful... Whatever, Israeli. 1919-1998. The moment of life, which is not important. The moment of death was definitely not important from a Jewish value. And this dash... This is the most important thing, is a dash. Your life, a dash. Look at the Jewish cemetery. A celebration of life. Here lies the righteous, the woman who gave alms and took care of babies and then opened charities. And they, if you know the language, I went to cemeteries in Poland where you read this, where you read it. It's part Aramaic and part Hebrew, part Polish, part Yiddish, part, because you can see in the cemetery also the extra influences that took place. You can see what happened in the 18th century. And then in the 19th century, you also see that there is hardly any Hebrew and a lot of Polish. Why? Because of assimilation. All of a sudden you see that there is something that took place in that landscape. You can bring people to a Jewish cemetery and create or reconstruct.
That's the new Jewish cemeteries in America look like that.
Here too.
Oh, guys, if you go to the right off Pinsker Street, Trumpeldor said, unbelievable, unbelievable. But guys, the reason I'm saying this to you, cemeteries in the Jewish mindset are a living landscape that tells a story of a living people. The cemetery was never divorced of the community in which it existed. It continued to tell its story. And it created also incredible opportunities to contextualize the Jewish experience. You know why? Because it's only in a cemetery that you can bring a scholar from the 17th century to dialogue with another person who lived 200 years later and are buried right next to them. And you can literally analyze the tombstone, see what had happened in those 200 years. You can create a dialogue with a so-called dead community, but do so, and that's what I meant when I say it's a living landscape, because you can now create a dialogue with a so-called dead community, but in its own language.
Well, you don't want to keep...
I heard that he said to put the Shema.
And?
Oh, what Daniel Perlman was, yeah.
That's history in 370.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. The kibbutz narrative, when they really created the kibbutz, is when they buried the first person on the kibbutz.
The what?
In the kibbutz narrative, the kibbutz was real when they buried the first person on the kibbutz.
Something else interesting that happened today on the news. France, nothing to do with Judaism, there was an argument because the justice minister proclaimed about pink triangles and claimed them as black triangles. And nothing to do with Judaism, but referring to the gay issues they're handling it, and that the black triangle is even worse than the pink triangle. Nothing to do with Judaism. So we aren't the only ones doing this.
No, no, of course. I mean. What I'm trying to give you an example of here is that if we actually look, we can find manners by which to contextualize the Holocaust and to demonstrate how important it is to study it, but not to study it as a Jewish event, but rather as an event that happened to the Jewish people. And the question of how do we respond to the Holocaust is not just a question to so-called Holocaust survivors. That now becomes our own question. And guys, we're losing so-called Holocaust survivors. I think about, I read, there was Yom Nitzolei HaShoah like a week ago, and they said that about 20 of them die every day. God bless them. But we are soon going to remain with only the memory in that respect. And in that respect, we have, in my opinion, a noble, noble obligation. It's a holy obligation. We owe it to their memory, not just to our own trajectory as Jews, but to their memory to remember their lives rather than to sanctify their death. You know, Tim Cole, a historian, dubbed a term that is very hard, but unfortunately...
What's his name?
Tim Cole. And he quotes someone who says that in our world there is no business like show a business. Hmm? I don't know if he coined it, but he definitely uses it. There's no business like Shoah business, which is a very... Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know that, but if that's true, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Right.
And the Polish economy is booming because of
Well, that. Now, I want to stay very, very focused on what I'm saying, because there are many, many ramifications. What all I'm saying is that we need to continue giving very serious thought to how we introduce the Holocaust to our younger generation, because if we continue by relying on the Holocaust as the prime language of inducing Jewish identity, we'll end up losing in the long run.
But what happens if this is the only identity that this child gets? Though?
It's horrific if that's the only identity that the child gets.
It's a fact.
It shouldn't be.
It shouldn't be, it couldn't be, it mustn't be, but it is.
No, it's not. I think there are many others who study many other things about Judaism.
Right, but there are many, many, many who do not.
So we need to mitigate that reality. That's exactly my point. It can be contextualized. It can be contextualized. It should be done with Israelis as well, by the way.
Of course.
Not just with Jews from around the world. But we need to have the courage to first of all continue with the language of deep respect and awe of those who had experienced this. This is why I devoted 45 minutes just for the introduction. And at the same time, not be afraid to say there comes a time where we need to revisit our educational narrative and contextualize the Holocaust in such a manner that it is used as yet another vehicle to admire the sustenance of Jewish life. I don't want to raise a generation of young Jews who wrap themselves with the flag of Israel and say, I want to be Jewish because. I don't want. I want them to put the Jewish flag of Israel on their shoulders because they're proud to be Jewish.
How does this differ from the way we educate toward Purim and the events of Purim? When we celebrate... when we try to wipe the face of
right.
Haman from this earth, or when we say Vehisham de la Otenu de la an Pesach, we teach the negative.
Right. Because yeah. I mean, but again, that's because unfortunately, you should read if you ever have a chance to read Alan Mintz, M-I-N-T-Z,
right.
Alan Mintz book. It came out in 1999 by Brandeis University Press. It's called Churban. Jewish responses to catastrophe. And it shows how Jews responded to catastrophe throughout the ages in poetry and literature. Catastrophe is so infused into our DNA.
But we can't deny it.
No, we can't. But we can definitely acknowledge the fact that catastrophe doesn't define us. That's what I'm saying. Because otherwise, look, you know, people say that Jewish identity is formed because of all of these persecutions and catastrophes. And say, okay, what will happen when the last anti-Semite dies off? Ah. In other words, on the one hand, we come and say anti-Semitism is blah, 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 and we rejected it. But on the other hand, there is a small hand here that keeps them close, because there is almost a sense of
We don't have them, that we're not going to disappear.
What do we do?
The political structure of this country is complicit in that.
Absolutely.
So that every time the prime minister down screams and yells about how the whole world is out to destroy the Jews, and we're about to face into all of us.
The world is yelling at themselves. He doesn't have to echo it.
But yet, when a foreign dignitary comes, the first stop is Yad Vashem.
Of course. Do I agree with it? No, not necessarily.
Don't we have some other value to...
yeah. Oh yeah, we do. I would still take them to Yad Vashem. But it will be contextualized with a much, much greater tour of Israel.
After the Weizmann Institute.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is not disrespectful. But when you come and you make it into the pivotal...
This becomes the primary thing for the outside world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Israel is not the only country. Other dignitaries go around the world, they go to the grave, and we had no soldiers.
That's fine.
World War II, but they're all...
That's different.
Every country outside of Israel, they're there with the
reason. But the grave of the unknown soldiers is celebrating a heroism. It's not celebrating a tragedy.
No, and again, I'm not saying, I don't know, well, and maybe you're right. The question is, what is the context? What is the context? Does Yad Vashem define me as a country? Or is Yad Vashem a commemoration?
May also be just that they wanted or couldn't oppress, that they're paying respect.
So we make them.
I would venture. No, I think that there is something here that is way beyond political. This is part of the national narrative of the Jewish people. I guess they would. I guess.
There's other symbols too.
Yeah.
Maybe our view is a lot.
But I don't know what other landscapes are there besides Yad Vashem and the Kotel. But these are very, very interesting questions. So basically, guys, what I try to say today, and I know that it only opens more questions. And again, I hope that I haven't offended anyone, not in here and not in anybody else who's hearing this. That basically, my point is that if we want to remember the Holocaust and remind of it, it is our obligation. Also for the memory and the honor that we have to the past, to contextualize the Holocaust in a much more positive, meaningful, ongoing, and proud Jewish life, rather than putting the pedestal or putting the Holocaust on a pedestal as the climate of Jewish life. And I think that once we do that, we'll be able to sustain a memory of the Holocaust which is in much better correspondence with major and significant Jewish values. Yeah.
I just want to add that Harold Schulweis, rabbi in California, very great man, had something to say about this, and I think was very wise. And he wrote a piece once about how unhealthy it is for us to have our curriculum in religious school in America centered on Holocaust events, and how unhealthy it is for Jewish children to grow up, as it were, in the shadow, always feeling that we were in a corner. Anyway, he made an interesting suggestion, which he created an organization called the Shifra and Puach Organization. The two Egyptian midwives who extended themselves to the Yaldot, who saved
Moses,
the Jewish children. And he said what we should do every Holocaust Memorial Day is we should teach about Shifra and Puah, not the biblical Shifra and Puah, but the righteous Gentiles. And that, yes, we know that there are righteous Gentiles and the walk of the righteous Gentiles in Yad Vashem, but it doesn't really get the kind of play that it should. It doesn't get the kind of play like the children's monument in Yad Vashem, where you walk in the hush and you see all the reflections, or in the Valley of the Lost Communities, or whatever it is. That even in the whole landscape, as you would call it, Yad Vashem, which has many different sections to it, death is the overwhelming experience. That is the idea of Jews being killed and dying. And the idea of the righteous Gentiles, that there were human beings who were moved to help us, is a kind of, by the way, you know, left-handed. Yeah. So his suggestion was that should be a very important part of every Jewish curriculum. that we concentrate every year on a different person, on a different story, and like that's why we call it Yom HaShoah V'Hagbura.
Right.
That we concentrate on Hagbura.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still concentrating on the Holocaust now.
Okay.
Thank you.
Toda, guys.
Thank you.